chapter of Deuteronomy, and the subject of this chapter, of course, is the re-giving of the covenant. In the very first few words, he says, "These are the words of the covenant," and that actually is the theme of this chapter. These are the words of the covenant. And what Moses has done up to this point in Deuteronomy, he has given the laws that the people are to keep, that they are responsible for, and he's also given the promises and the threatenings that God has given that he's going to be responsible for, and God will carry out these promises or these threatenings depending upon the action of the people and their being faithful to him. And now he kind of sums the whole thing up here in a covenant form in the 29th chapter, and it's a reiteration of the covenant. So he says, "These are the words of the covenant, which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab." This is not a covenant that Moses decided to make. It's not a covenant that Moses was the author of, although Moses was an inspired man and he was the great leader of the nation, the great leader of the age, and one of the greatest leaders of all history. Moses did not have the authority to make this covenant. He couldn't word it the way he wanted it to be worded. It was a covenant given by God. And so he says, which the Lord commanded Moses to make. And that's true of all of the commands that we have. The commands come from God. God uses men as agents through which he gives these commands. Nevertheless, they do not come from men. Men are not the author of them. God is the author, and God commands then men, or in this case Moses, to make the covenant, to give the teachings, to pass on his will and his word and his way. So we need to be very careful then to see that the things that we follow are not things that are made by man, things that have been originated and invented by man, but simply things that man has passed on as a result of what God has given. And our teaching today should be most carefully constructed around the fact that it's not something new that we have imagined or invented, but it is something that we're simply reflecting that's already been given by God. So, the words of the covenant, which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab. Now, you remember Moab is where they are right now, just before they're ready to cross over the Jordan River into Canaan. They're here in the plains of Moab while Moses is given this teaching in the book of Deuteronomy. And they arrived in Moab some 40 years after they first went into the wilderness and received the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai. Now, you know, on Mount Sinai, he made a covenant with them. That was the covenant. It included the Ten Commandments and all of the articles of faith, all of the laws pertaining to the priesthood and the service and the tabernacle and the worship to God. That was a covenant. But now he's making another covenant in the land of Moab, and he says here that it is beside the covenant which he made with them in Horeb. That is the covenant he made in Mount Sinai. This is a covenant beside that one. And actually, when we look at it, it's really the same covenant. The covenant wasn't changed, but he simply was giving it again. And due to the fact that he was restating this covenant, renewing it, giving them a fresh start, then it can be said it was beside the one in Horeb, because the one in Horeb was so violated by the people that God had every right to not fulfill any part of that covenant, because the people did not live up to their part of the agreement. They failed God in many, many ways. But now he's remaking this covenant, and he's giving them a fresh chance, and so he's called it here beside the covenant which he made with them in Horeb. Another thing to remember is that most of the people that are here in the presence of Moses during this teaching in Deuteronomy were not of age, or maybe not even born at the time that that covenant was given in Horeb. So they weren't personally present or personally of age to fully participate in the making of the original covenant. So here's making it again. Just before they go into the land of Canaan, God makes the covenant fresh. They're starting all over. It's as though they had an entirely brand new start. All the sins of the past have nothing to do now with the covenant because the covenant is being restated. Verse 2, And Moses called unto all Israel and said unto them, Ye have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt unto Pharaoh and unto all his servants and unto all his land. Now what Moses is doing here is a prelude to the giving of the covenant or the ratifying of the covenant. He is reminding the people of the great things that God has done, of the greatness of God himself. And if they can be made to see and be caused to have a remembrance of all the great things that God has done, then they will be more apt to believe that God's going to bring about the things he talks about in the future, the promises. It's easy to believe that he can produce future promises if you can believe that he's already produced things this great. And that's true for us even today. If we can know more about God, the history of God, the things that God has done for his people, then it's not too hard to believe that he's going to continue to do similar things for us yet in the future. If a person has no concept that God's ever done anything in the past, then it's harder to believe that he can bring these things about in the future. So that's what Moses is doing here. He's reminding them what God's done. The first thing he reminds them of is the things that God did for them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt where they were slaves. He took this people that were not a nation. They had no king. They had no leader. They were slaves. They had lost their identity, so to speak. They were at the very bottom of the social and economic and political ladder in Egypt. And he took them and brought them out. He made them a nation. He made them a people. He became their God. And it was a miraculous change of events for them. So as Moses brings these things to their remembrance, it's for the purpose of causing them to know the great powers that God has. And so here's the way he words it. You have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes. They were eyewitnesses of this. They had seen this, or at least their ancestors had seen it. And most of them, or many of them, had seen these things. They'd seen what he'd done in the wilderness. He's not just telling them some kind of a fairy tale. These are actual events that were documented. They'd seen it, and God was responsible for it. You've seen all the things that God did before your eyes in the land of Egypt unto Pharaoh and unto all his servants and unto all his land. Now, there were terrible and great things done to Pharaoh. The 10 plagues were brought up on Egypt, which involved Pharaoh and involved all his servants and all his land. All the people in the whole nation of Egypt were involved. They were brought into this thing because the very nature of God was able to make it great enough that nobody could escape. And these Israelites who received the benefits, they saw all this. And he names here in verse 3 some of the things he did. The great temptations which thine eyes have seen, the signs and those great miracles. Now, I think the great temptations refer to the trials that Egypt themselves had to experience. The trials they came through, testing them, testing their faith. But then the signs that he gave and those great miracles, including the plagues, and the worst one, of course, was the death angel which came. Their great deliverance, the opening of the waters of the Red Sea, the drowning of the Egyptian army, all the things. Verse 4, then he shows in verse 4 how that the people had not taken advantage of this knowledge. They had not truly attributed this greatness and power and might to God. They had, and by their actions, they had forgotten it, or they'd never really realized it. For it says in verse 4, Yet the Lord hath not given you an heart to perceive, and eyes to see, and ears to hear unto this day. They had acted so stubbornly. They had acted so sinfully, turning against God time after time after time, that he simply says here inference to their disobedience and hard-heartedness, that God hadn't given them a heart to know or to see, and eyes to see and ears to hear unto this day. They hadn't really had this to register upon them as a people, as a nation, that God had done these things for them. They'd forgotten God. They'd been rebellious against God. They had refused to obey God and turned against him on numerous occasions. And that's a reference to this. And today, when we do not follow God, when we disobey, when we forget about God, we're really doing it because we don't have a heart to perceive, nor eyes to see, nor ears to hear what God has really done for us. We blatantly and willingly and voluntarily forget about him. And it truly is a tragic thing if you can just stop and take a look at what God has done for the people and how the people then behaved in return to God. And this is the way God looked upon it. You haven't seen, and you haven't heard, you haven't understood. To this very day, he said. Then he continues in verse 5 with the things that he had done for them. Leading up now to this giving of the covenant again, he says in verse 5, "And I have led you 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes are not waxen old upon you, and thy shoe is not waxen old upon thy foot." Now to me, this is one of the greatest of all the miracles that they could actually experience and see day by day. You remember when they left Egypt, over in Exodus, the 12th chapter, they were told to eat the Passover, and a part of this instruction to them to eat the Passover in Exodus 12, verse 11, "And thus shall you eat it, with your loins girded, your shoes on your feet, and your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover." And we're not going to discuss the Passover, but the point I want to make is, at that time they put their shoes on their feet, and they girded their loins. And so here he says, "Your clothes are not waxing old upon you, and thy shoe is not waxing old upon thy foot." The very same clothes, the very same shoes they put on that night they ate the Passover before they left Egypt, those shoes and those clothes stayed with them for 40 years and did not wear out. They did not become old. Now that truly is a miracle. That's one of the things that Moses points out to them, that they're able to see, they're able to know about, that is proof of the greatness of God and proof of God and of the ability for God to keep his promises. He further states in verse 6, "You have not eaten bread, neither have you drunk wine or strong drink, that you might know that I am the Lord your God." All this time in the wilderness, they didn't eat the things that other people would eat to give them strength and to give them pleasure. They ate the manna from heaven and the water that God gave them. And this was all during the wilderness. This was to show that God was leading them, that they had a miraculous being that was caring for them, and it was not left up to them to provide for the things by their own hands the way that other people provided for themselves, but they were given manna from heaven and the water to drink that God provided. Now, one side note here is that any observance of the Passover done in the wilderness was not done with wine nor strong drink. It would have to have been done with the thing that Jesus took on the night that he instituted the Lord's Supper, the fruit of the vine, which would not have been true wine, but it would have been the grape juice. Verse 7, now he here gives a third thing that they should know about that God had done. First of all, he talks about their deliverance from Egypt. Second of all, he talks about their treatment while in the wilderness, how God cared for them. Now, thirdly, he talks about the victories they had when they came into this land of Moab. Verse 7, "And when you came unto this place," which is Moab, where they now are, "Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan, came out against us unto battle, and we smote them. Now, we studied this in the first part of Deuteronomy, and I refer you back to those lessons to get the details about the battle with Sihon and Og. But the children of God were victorious. They did take this land. And that's what he says in verse 8. And we took their land and gave it for an inheritance unto Reuben, unto the Reubenites, and to the Gadites, and to the half tribe of Manasseh. Now remember, this land that they got from Og and Sihon, this land was what they possessed that was east of the Jordan River. It's quite a large possession. And the tribes that inherited that land were the ones he names here, Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh. And you know, part of the agreement was that Reuben, Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh would help them go on into Canaan and conquer the land of Canaan. Then in return for that, they could inherit this land east of the Jordan. But they got it from the victories that they won from Sihon and Og. So he's reminding them of the great things that God has done. And the results of this reminder are that they then can have a strong belief in this covenant that God is making with them. They can believe that God will carry out what he said he's going to do, and he's already told them the blessings, and he's already told them the curses. It depends upon whether or not they're going to be obedient. But they are now in a position to believe that God can carry out what he said he's going to do. So in verse 9 he says, keep therefore the word of this covenant, and do them, that you may prosper in all that you do. Now here is the warning, the reminder, even a strong command, to keep the words of this covenant. God doesn't just give a covenant just to be doing something, just to be taking up space and time. He gives it for the purpose of the people keeping it. And so that's what he says. Keep the words of this covenant and do them that you may prosper in all that you do. Here again is that thread that runs throughout the Bible, in which God has as the bottom line of everything the fact that we are to obey. We are to keep his commands. to keep the covenant, to keep the words of this covenant, would include the idea of knowing about them, being reminded of them, remembering them, possessing them, and then doing them is the actual carrying out of, the actual being obedient to God. Keep the word of this covenant and do them. And the result of that is going to be that you may prosper in all that you do. That is the promise of God. If you keep his covenant, if you do his commands, if you do what he says, you're going to prosper in all that you do. This is not only prosperity in the spiritual realm, and that you're going to be a spiritual being of God, in the family of God, ready to receive the good benefits from the spiritual side, but it also includes benefits from the temporal and physical side. You're going to have a healthy body. You're going to have a productive work life. You're going to have a financial success. That doesn't mean you're going to be a millionaire, but you're going to live as good as anybody else lives so far as being able to enjoy life and being able to provide for the things for your family and for yourself that you need. And that's how you get this. This is the key to prosperity. Keep the word of this covenant, do them, that you may prosper in all that you do. Now we know that in the church age, the covenant has changed. He's made a new covenant. Jeremiah 31, beginning with the 31st verse, and Hebrews 8th chapter, and Hebrews the 10th chapter also alludes to this. But even though in the New Testament, this covenant is a new covenant. It's still the principle of keeping the words of the covenant and doing them that you may prosper in all that you do. That principle still applies to us today. That is the one principle by which we can know that we are members of the family of God. The only way that we can know that we love God is to keep His commandments. And He's promised that if we keep His commandments, He's going to come with us and dwell with us, and He'll be our God. So it's so important that we know what the covenant is and that we do it, that we keep it, that we are obedient servants to God. Now, beginning in verse 10, we turn to more specifics of the covenant. It seems that as Moses was now beginning to come closer to the end of his discourse in this book of Deuteronomy, that he is becoming more fervent and more zealous in his speech to try to impress upon the minds of this unthinking people the true importance of this covenant. He's trying to show them that they really now have one last chance to be the people of God, and that it all depends upon their being faithful to Him and using this covenant as the vehicle through which they can then come to God and have God to be their true God. And so he begins by describing the parties to the covenant. As we know, the man on one side, God on the other side. These are the two parties of the covenant. But let's notice the way that Moses describes this. In verse 10 he says, "Ye stand this day, all of you, before the Lord your God." Now here they are in the position of making and ratifying the covenant. "Your captains of your tribes, your elders and your officers, with all the men of Israel." Now, as we look at man as being one of the parties to this covenant, he describes the various stations of life. The first thing he mentions here are your captains of your tribes, your elders, and your officers. So the high places, the officers, the captains, the elders, these men also were involved in the covenant. There is no position in life too high for a man not to have the need of humbling himself and making covenant with God. We never reach the point in which we are not in need of this covenant with God. So the highest of the high must enter into the same covenant with God that the lowest of the low do, if they're going to be acceptable to God. This group is usually the hardest group to cause to be humbled, to realize they have a need for, to realize they have a poor spirit, and to seek after assistance from God. Then he says, "with all the men of Israel." Now, all the men. There was not anyone who was going to be left out. All the men of Israel. So, when we're thinking about a covenant with God, this is the most unifying and the most equalizing of all activities that man can participate in, because this makes all men truly equal to have a covenant with God. Then in verse 11, "your little ones, your wives." Now, this not only included the men, but it also included the women and the children. Your little ones and your wives. Certainly the wives, the women, they are as much in covenant relationship with God as anybody else. And they're included in this covenant. They're named specifically in this covenant, so that they are also then a part of the covenant. Then he says, "your little ones." The smallest of children should be brought to the Lord. That is, they should be exposed to all of the things of God. They should be present at the worship services of God. They should be present during times of family Bible discussions and time of family prayer. They should be exposed to the things of God from the very earliest of infancy. And he even describes the little ones here as having this standing here before God as the covenant is being made. And then he describes, "and thy stranger that is in thy camp." Now, not only is it the Israelites here, but any stranger in the camp, this would include the proselytes, those that have a desire to serve this true and living God. He also is included in this covenant. The strangers in our camp. And this is the very first mention that we have of God showing favor toward the Gentiles, actually. So That's where we today kind of get our foot in the door as Gentiles. God showing favor to us also, the stranger that's in thy camp. And if any of our ancestors who lived back that early, we who are Gentiles, if any of our ancestors were servants of God, they were servants in this way. That is being a stranger in the camp of Israel and then wanting to serve this true and living God. And then he describes, from the hewer of thy wood unto the drawer of thy water, the very lowest menial servant, the ones that did the most undesirable jobs, they too were included in the covenant. And then he, let's skip down to show that he includes some others here in verse 14. Neither with you only do I make this covenant and this oath, but with him that standeth here with us this day before the Lord our God, and with also with him that is not here with us this day. So it included not only those that were standing here in the presence of Moses, but those that weren't standing there. Maybe there were some at home sick. Maybe there were some at home who couldn't make it for various and sundry reasons. But they also were included in the covenant. And then this would also include those future generations who hadn't even been born at this time, who would in the next 50, 7500 years then be bearing the standard of God. They also were included in the covenant, although they weren't even present, they weren't even born. So this is an all-encompassing covenant for God's people, including those not present, whether in physical presence at that day, or whether even not even existing on this earth at the time the covenant was given, but yet to come into it at a future time. Now in verse 12, he tells the other side of the covenant. He described all of the men, the high men, the captains, the elders, the officers, the little ones, the wives, the strangers, the hewer of the wood, the drawer of the water, the ones present, the ones not present. Now he's going to describe the other party to the covenant, who is God. Verse 12, that thou shouldest enter into covenant with the Lord thy God and into his oath, which the Lord thy God maketh with thee this day. Now God is the one who is going to keep his part of it. You're entering a covenant with the Lord thy God. You're entering into his oath, which the Lord thy God maketh with thee this day. There's no other party now that you're making the covenant with. It's God. And we've got to realize that we're at the very top of the scale now when we are approaching God. God's going to keep his part of the covenant. He's going to keep his part of the bargain. He's going to live up to every agreement that he has made. And so this is a cause for the most solemn of occasions, for the most deep thought and dedication and realization that this is God we're dealing with. Now in verse 13, he tells the purpose of the covenant. That he may establish thee today for a people unto himself, and that he may be unto thee a God, as he has said unto thee, and as he has sworn unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. This covenant was not just a take it or leave it proposition. If you wanted to be a people that was established unto God, you had to enter into this covenant. That was the purpose of the covenant, so that he could do this. Outside of the covenant, outside of obedience that he requires to his will, it is impossible then to have a relationship with God, the kind of relationship we want to have with God. He cannot and will not be our God. He will not have us to be his people. So we must then have the covenant with God. As we know today in the New Testament age, we have a new covenant, a covenant that he didn't make with the people at this time. But the principle is the same. If we're going to have a relationship with God where we're going to be his people and he's going to be our God, we must have the covenant. We must do our part of the agreement in order for God then to be held as responsible for his part of the agreement. And he says, that he may be unto thee a God, as he hath said unto thee, and as he hath sworn unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. He refers back to their ancestors, to these forefathers, to these patriarchs, that as he said to them, this is a principle that God has had all through time now. It's not just some new thing that's cropped up here. God has always demanded this covenant in order to have a relationship with his people. And it's true today in our dealings with our fellow man. When we enter into some kind of an agreement with a another party that is a serious agreement, a long-standing agreement, we have it written out in a contract form. If we're going to go buy a house and pay on that house for 15 years or so and make so much every month's going to be on the principal, so much on the interest and so on, we have an agreement all written out. It's all nice and legal, and anybody can come and read it and understand exactly what we're supposed to be doing. No question about it. And we do that in many other things. And so it is with God. It's understood what our part is and what his part is. It's not some vague relationship in which we just kind of believe in God and do whatever we seem to think is right and just have a good feeling about it all and go on our merry way and God's well pleased with us. There's an agreement here. There's a covenant here. We have to know what it says. And sometimes the details of it can get a little bit meticulous, and it requires some digging out. It requires some knowledge, some understanding. You know, in the covenants that men make, they even have to have a lawyer sometimes to enter in and interpret the thing as to exactly what it does mean. And so we have this same agreement with God, and it requires some diligence on our part because it's found in God's Word. It requires a knowledge. It requires some effort, some study, just to know what it is. And then it requires effort to obey it, to follow the commands, to be really obedient to it. As we move on down to verse 16, we see here is given the reason for the covenant. The reason for this covenant was to fortify them against idolatry. And in verses 16 and 17, he shows them the danger of temptation to participate in idolatry. In verse 16 he says, "For ye know how we have dwelt in the land of Egypt, and how we came through the nations which ye passed by, and how ye have seen their abominations, and their idols, wood and stone, silver and gold, which were among them." So you people have been exposed to idolatry. You've seen it. Well, we used to live in Egypt. And then when we came out of Egypt, those 40 years, we passed through these other nations that had idolatry. And you've seen their abominations. You've seen their idols, the wood and stone and silver and gold which were among them. So you've been exposed to it. Now, ordinarily, you would think that this this seeing of idolatry, this seeing of people who worshiped other gods, would cause God's people to get closer to him. But there are always those who are going to be tempted when they see these things. They want to participate. They want to taste of. They want to have these foreign gods, this forbidden fruit. They want to participate in it. And there's a temptation there. And he names this temptation. You've been among idolatry all of your lives. You've seen it. It's been on every hand. And so you're going to have a temptation. Now, not everybody's going to be tempted, but some will be. And this is so highly applicable to us today. For we, from our very earliest infancy in our society, are exposed to idolatry on every hand. Every place we look, there is idolatry. There is paganism. There is the keeping of the religious holidays that come directly from paganism and are contrary to the Bible and that have nothing to do with the service of God. These things are kept. They're encouraged by us to be kept in the schools. The public schools perpetuate these things. Many and most, even of the churches, so-called, perpetuate these false religious holidays. And idolatry is everywhere. And most of the religions of the day, most of the denominations even, support idolatry even unknowingly. This great false religion, this great Babylon that has swept our nation and it is encompassing the world, actually, puts these things forth in such a pleasurable, tempting, desirable fashion that it's easy to be tempted to participate in this. And so many of the things that we see daily, and they are so much a part of the scene that we just take them for granted, are really things that are dangerous to us. And so we have to come out of this. We have to realize that we are highly tempted. We are in a position to be very vulnerable to idolatry. And that's the same as it was with the people then. They had lived in the land of Egypt. They had passed through these nations where idolatry was. They'd seen their abominations, their idols, their wood, their stone, silver, and gold, which were among them. We today, in most of our communications, whether it be the newspaper or a magazine or television or radio, we're bombarded with these things. They use sex as a symbol to sell everything from automobiles to clothing. We're tempted to take up the habit of smoking cigarettes. We're tempted to drink alcohol. We're tempted to go to places where Christians shouldn't be seen, and to use language that's contrary to God and to Christianity. On and on and on, these temptations are portrayed before us as pleasurable, delightful, nice, acceptable things to do. And so we have it on every hand, and we see it. We see it, we see it. And the nature of man is, when he sees something like this, he wants to participate, he wants to taste, he wants to indulge in it. And so that's what he's warning them about here in verses 16 and 17. And so beginning in the 18th verse now, he describes the sinner who would participate in this. He says in verse 18, "Lest there should be among you man or woman or family or tribe." See, everybody's susceptible, not just one group of people. Man or woman or a family or a tribe whose heart turneth away. Now that is the description of the sinner. That's the first step to ruin. Whose heart turneth away this day from the Lord our God. Now, if you want to take the first step towards sin, just let your heart turn away from God. That's what they have to do. That's the first thing they do. Their heart turns away from God. They begin to forget about God. They begin to think about these other pleasures. They study them. They learn about them. They then actually participate in them. Their hearts turned away from God. You know, as long as you're thinking about God, as long as they are being reminded of the greatness of God and the desires of God, then it's not such a temptation. But just let your heart stop thinking about God. Turn away from God. Let something else fill that void that's created whenever you forget about God, which it will do. And then, first thing you know, you're going to be participating in this idolatry, which is all around us every day. You know, this idea of not forgetting about God is such an important facet of our being that we can't stress it enough. Over in Isaiah 62, verse 6, he makes a statement, "I have set watchmen upon thy walls, O Jerusalem, which shall never hold their peace day nor night. Ye that make mention of the Lord, keep not silence." These watchmen are the teachers of God. They are the ones who are the overseers of God's people. And he says, "Ye that make mention of the Lord," and this phrase, "make mention of the Lord," means to bring to remembrance the Lord. "You that bring to remembrance the Lord, keep not silence." And that's the purpose of God's teachers, is to bring to remembrance the Lord, cause other people to remember the Lord. Peter said in 2 Peter 1 that he would not cease to cause them to have a remembrance. His purpose was to make them remember. And he says, even after my decease, after I've left this life, I will endeavor so that you can always have these things in remembrance. So it's important that we continue to remember the things of God. And when we begin to forget them, then something else is going to replace our thoughts. Something else is going to be put in there that's not from God, that's from another source. And this is the first step toward sinning. Whose heart turneth away this day from the Lord our God, to go and serve the gods of these nations. That's what you have to do when you turn away from God. You have to serve the God of some other nation. You're not going to be serving the God of the church anymore. You're not going to be serving the God who is the Creator. You're going to be serving the God of some other nation, a foreign God, an idol. And that is the very first quality of the sinner. His heart is turned away from God. That's the first step toward ruin. And as we're trying to identify sinners and trying to determine if we're sinners or not, let's determine whether or not our heart has turned away from God or not. As we continue to describe the character of the sinner in verse 18, he concludes by saying, "Lest there should be among you a root that beareth gall and wormwood." And what this means is, this sinner is a very dangerous man. Not only is he corrupted, not only does he fail to have a lack of God himself, and he wants to go after the gods of other nations, strange gods, gods that are contrary to what the true and living God would have you to accept, he wants to corrupt those round about him. He's a poison. He is a root that beareth gall and wormwood. His fruits are fruits that, if they're partaken of, will contaminate somebody else. So this is another characterization of a sinner. A sinner is a dangerous person, actually. A person that you can't just say, well, they're wrong, but they're harmless. Because they can, in their error, they can convert somebody else to their way. They can taint somebody else. And it's kind of like having a rotten apple in a barrel of other apples. If you don't get the rotten apple out, you're going to ruin some other apples. And that's what he's saying about the sinner here, that he is a root that beareth gall and wormwood. And in the New Testament, we have a reference to this in Hebrews the 12th chapter, verses 14 and 15, where the writer there says, "Follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord, looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled." Now, this writer in the New Testament is simply saying that if you do have a root of bitterness spring up like this, if you do have a sinner happen to be in the midst of you, thereby then, many may be defiled. That is, this sinner is the source of the defilement of others. And he says many in the New Testament. Many may be defiled. So you can't take sin lightly, nor can you take a sinner lightly. Because the character of a sinner follows this principle of being a potential threat to the well-being of the spiritual state of others. In verse 19, we find another characterization of a sinner, and that is that he has security in sin. Most people who sin, somehow or other, are able to lull themselves into a sense of security, thinking, well, everything's going to be all right. I know I'm doing wrong, but it's not going to really have that much effect on me. It's not going to really cause me any harm.